Have you been listening to the podcast and getting value from the show? If so, I've got a small favor to ask, because over the next few months, we're going to be making some changes to better serve you. Now, I could keep creating episodes based on what I think would be most helpful, but I would much rather get this right. So instead of guessing, I want to understand where you are right now and the real challenges you, your organization, and your team are facing. That's why I've put together a very short 90-second survey. It'll help me better understand you and how I can serve you at a much higher level. And as a thank you, the first 30 people who complete it will receive a free signed copy of one of our books. To take part, just go to the show notes and click the link titled Leadership Survey. Or you can go directly to letsgrowleaders.com/podsurvey. PODSURVEY. It'll take less than 2 minutes. I really appreciate your input. It will genuinely help shape the future of the show.
So what helps us is building the habits. Habits, of course, they're like these little wired steps that we have in our brain that lead to mental strength. As I often say, I believe that building the right habits are what train your brain for achievement. If you actually build habits to be mentally stronger, it is the same thing as training your brain for achievement.
Hey, it's David, and you're listening to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul, your source for practical leadership inspiration, tools, and strategies you can use to achieve transformational results without sacrificing your humanity or your mind in the process.
Hey, welcome to the show. Today's episode is going to be fantastic. I haven't even heard it or had the discussion yet, but I already know that. And here's why. You're going to get specific habits you can use to build your executive presence, be a leader that naturally cultivates confidence in other people and inspires greatness in your teams. How do you do all that? By building your mental strength. And our guest today is going to give you practical ways to build your fortitude, your confidence, your boldness, and so much more. And you might, if you've been a longtime listener, you might recognize his name because Scott Motz joined us. Gosh, it was season 8, episode 4, and here we are in season 17. So it has been a minute, Scott.
Yeah, I'd like to think I'm responsible for your longevity, David, but I don't think I had anything to do with it. So catapulted you into the. I thought that was the case. So I'm just.
I have to disagree with you there because you're the first book that not your first book, but the first book we had you on the show for was Leading from the Middle. Which, listener, that's not what we're talking about today. But if you have not read Leading from the Middle, it is the best book on like middle management, middle center, organizational leadership from the center, from the middle that I have ever read. It is fantastic. And we're going to get an equal level of quality today, Scott. So let me just tell everybody a little bit about you. And then for those who maybe don't remember from season 8, and then we'll get going. So Scott's a former senior executive at Procter & Gamble and successfully ran several of the company's largest multi-billion dollar businesses. As we already picked up, he's the author of 4 different multi-award-winning books, including the one we just mentioned, Leading from the Middle. But today we're going to be talking about The Mentally Strong Leader, Build the Habits to Productively Regulate Your Emotions, Thoughts, and Behaviors. And I'm going to put this again as must read for any leader who really wants to cultivate those things. We'll figure out what all that means, but it is that good. Scott's a faculty on reserve at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business for Executive Education. LinkedIn Learning course instruction, where he's got over 1.5 million views and counting. I know you're probably just in the last 20 minutes up to 2 million already or something. There's a lot there. Been named a CEO thought leader by CEO Executive Guild at Inc.com, where Scott was named a top 50 leadership innovators. Columns drew nearly 2 million readers a month. Obviously a very smart, talented, but most importantly, human-centered leader. Scott, welcome back to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul.
Thanks for having me back here, David. I'm honored to be a repeat guest and to frankly even be in the shadow of your presence. So happy to be here, man.
We are, for listeners, if you're watching, there's no video for you to watch here, but we are both brightly lit. There are no shadows.
We get one thing right. It's the lighting, right?
We got the lighting. We got the audio. You can see us. You can hear us. So we can see each other. All right. So Scott, obviously you've been on the show before, so I always have people take us back to the earliest memory of themselves as a leader. But I'm going to ask you, since you've already answered that question, and we're talking about the mentally strong leader, What's one of your earliest, and you have in your introduction, you talk about a specific leader that you observed, and maybe that's it. But when you think about some of your earliest cognition or thinking around this subject of mentally strong leadership, like how far back does that go? When did that start? What were some of the things that started sensitizing you to this?
Yeah, and to get to that, so I'll start for your listeners, David, with a very quick definition of mental strength, so we're all on the same page, because, you know, many people have their own belief of what they think it is or what it isn't. You know, mental strength, quite simply, is it's the ability to regulate your emotions, your thoughts, and your behaviors productively, even in the face of adversity. As I like to shorthand it, David, it's often how we manage internally so that you can lead externally. And here's where it gets to your question about, you know, when did this first start to percolate? I think, David, I think your listeners, they intuitively understand. They get that. If they want to be able to succeed at work and in life, a basic function is to be able to productively regulate your emotions and your thoughts and your behaviors. Like, I'm not bringing tablets down from the mountain and telling you that. We all know that. The thing is, David, it's really hard to do it. And it's really hard to do it well. And this first started, the topic of mental strength started percolating for me. You know, some people often ask me, how long did it take you to write The Mentally Strong Leader? David, my answer is 30 years, because it's been percolating as a topic for 3 decades, you know, as I spent not only researching the topic, but living in, you know, in the corporate world. And I began to notice a real difference in leaders that really stood out, that were able to achieve, that when you think of the highest achieving organizations, you know, you've ever been a part of, the ones that overcame the most obstacles, I started to notice attributes of key leaders consistently surfacing. And those same attributes surfacing when I asked other people, like, what do you think of when you think of the best leader that you've ever worked for that overcame a ton of obstacles? And I started to see this discerning factor that I call mental strength. This ability to regulate your emotions. And I could put leaders almost into categories as I grew up through the organization. Like, wow, he or she is really mentally strong. And, you know, we'll get more into the mental muscles of mental strength in a minute. But I could put into a clear camp of, they are getting so much done as a leader. We are achieving so much as an organization because our leader is leading us with a tremendous amount of mental strength. Or not. And I saw that as a key discerning point early in my career. Does that surprise you at all that I would have seen that so early?
It doesn't surprise me that you would see it. What surprised me and I thought was so powerful. So, I mean, as soon as I heard the title of your book and knowing you and knowing your previous work, The Mentally Strong Leader, as soon as I even in the pre-publicity saw this is a book, it's going to be, oh my goodness, I have to read this, because I knew that it was going to be good. What surprised me, if anything, was in the opening of the book, in the introduction, you describe a senior leader who you observed, who had what I think traditionally many of us would think about as executive presence.
Yes.
The person was calm. Yep. They handled criticism well. Yep. In the face of adversity, they still maintained some confidence and positivity, and they were inspired. And you used the word sparkly, I think. They were calm, they were calm, but they almost sparkled in a way that was attractive, and that it was like, hey, follow me, we got this, right?
That's right.
And so it's like intuitively, as soon as you say, what that represents is mental strength, makes perfect sense, right? And when I think about leaders that I have been, that I have known or that I've worked for who didn't have those qualities and lacked that kind of executive presence, like, you know, it's just one of those phrases that gets tossed around so often. And what does it really mean? What you're talking about is so practical in terms of being mentally strong and what those habits and what those muscles look like, that I thought that was incredibly valuable, even for stage setting. So does it surprise me? No. Intuitively, yes, but I think the connection you make about what it looks like on the outside, that thing that we all want, or hopefully as leaders we're wanting that, here's how you get there. And that's why I think this is such an incredibly important and practical book for everyone to check out.
Yeah, what's interesting, David, to your point is, I found when you say the term mental strength, it connects a lot of dots for people, you know, and I was telling you, I actually formalized, much like you and Karen do, you know, formal research. I do the same thing. And I formalized this thought multiple times with over 3,000 study participants at a time, where I asked them the one question, thinking of the highest achieving organizations you've ever been a part of that overcame the most obstacles, what were the attributes of the key leader at the time? And they didn't, when they described that person, they didn't always use the term mental strength.
Right.
I asked them, well, what were the attributes? And they described what are the six mental muscles of mental strength, which are fortitude, confidence, boldness, decisiveness, the ability to stay focused on your goals, and what I call messaging, the ability to stay positive-minded and engaged with your audience and the impressions you leave in your communications. And they would describe those things. And sometimes I would use the term as a connector. So would you say then this person is mentally strong that you're describing? And you could see a light bulb going on, like, that's it. That's what they are. They are this. So even when I didn't offer up proactively, to your point, David, I found the idea of mental strength to be a great connector. You know, my hope is that mental strength becomes the next emotional intelligence of our time, because emotional intelligence is just a slice of the broader umbrella called mental strength. And I hope that the words mental strength trigger that to discern the kind of leader people want to be moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the reason that I find this to be such an important topic, and why I wanted to have you on the show, feature the work, and hope the listeners really that you'll engage with this, dive in. And I got to tell you, in the time we have today, we are not even going to scratch the surface and do it justice. There is so a wealth, and I say this from like a really positive person, there is a wealth of opportunity here in this book for you to dig in and invest where it's going to make the difference for you. But as you think about those skills and what it looks like to have that kind of leadership with your folks at whatever level you're at, it's easy to put our focus on the outside. And the thing that's so valuable here is that the outside is just an expression of what we're doing in our head and in our emotions and in all of that. And that's what you've unpacked us for. And as you said, super research-based, to help us be those self-disciplined, difficult to rattle, even-keeled leaders that sparkle. So as we dive into this, Scott, I want to, so you already defined it for us, which I think that ability to regulate emotions and behaviors across circumstances, and particularly when things are tough. Let's also go to the opposite side. What are we not talking about? Because I think, again, as you were saying, sometimes people automatically go and they say mentally strong. Well, what does that mean? What does it not mean?
Yeah, sometimes, David, people assume, you know, like the opposite of mentally strong is not mentally weak, right? You know, we all have a baseline of mental strength that we can draw from in our life to build upon. And, you know, and we'll get into deeper how you improve each mental muscle and improve your mental strength. But it's, you know, mental strength is not the absence of mental weakness. Mental strength is, you know, not mental health. That is a different topic that is very, very worthy of, you know, a whole different field of discussion. You know, mental strength is not being tough. And a lot of people think, oh, yeah, mental strength is, you know, I'm tough. I can take no matter what you throw at me. You know, I'm not going to feel any emotions. You know, I'm going to check my emotions at the door, which, by the way, David, never works. Never works. We're human beings. We're not robots. You know, mental strength is it's not mental toughness. You know, mental strength is not emotional intelligence. As I mentioned earlier, it's a bigger, broader umbrella than that. It is the broader thought of being able to productively regulate your emotions, your thoughts, and behaviors for a really powerful outcome that helps you to achieve, because this correlation to achievement is undeniable.
And related to that, you cited this research that I had never seen before about silver medalists, Olympic silver medal winners, who, you know, we all think of, gosh, those poor silver medal winners. Once, you know, they were one podium short, just one step up from that gold. Oh, well. And yet you found some, there's some interesting research there that comes to bear on this whole mental strength aspect of leadership.
Yeah, I like to ask people, you know, if you have a choice, would you rather be a gold medal winner or a silver medal winner? And I usually get a very puzzled look.
Like, well,
yeah. Dude, well, yeah.
Sign me up for the gold. Come on now.
Yeah, sign me up for the gold all day long. But this one very fascinating study that I encountered in my, you know, decades-long research, I've been doing this, shows it's a study of over 650 different Olympic athletes, David, you know, 50 plus countries, from all different disciplines of sports, if you will, from all around the world. And it found that studying these Olympic athletes, you know, over lives, they put them into two camps, gold medal winner and silver medal winner. And they discovered that in this research that actually the silver medal winners were the ones that were more successful ultimately, made more money, had better jobs, were happier, were more fulfilled. Because as it turns out, they are the epitome of people who have learned to deal with a setback, right? Your first reaction might be, oh, boo-hoo, they only won the silver medal. But you got to remember the genetic makeup of a lot of Olympic athletes. They are in that thing to prove they're the best in the world. And when they don't, it is a traumatic setback, especially if they're in a situation like I tell the story of the, you know, the women's Olympic hockey team from the United States in 2014 that, you know, a lot of people say they didn't win the silver, they lost the gold. They lost the game in the last 2 minutes, and then in overtime, you know, it got tied, and then in overtime they lost it. And so they especially had to deal with this trauma of not winning the gold. But what it found is it's these formative setbacks in our life that shape who we are, that make us better. And, you know, for all my listening friends out there, here's the thing. You have the opportunity to face one of these setbacks, not just once every 4 years, like Olympic athletes, but every single day if you're a leader and you're on the front line. It just shows you the importance of fortitude, which is the most common muscle associated with mental strength.
Well, and that gets us into those six. And oh, by the way, you even said, as I recall, like they live longer too. Those silver medalists.
They actually, like statistically. How could I forget that? They actually live longer because they learn to deal with setbacks and they build their resilience and their strength to do that.
That is fascinating. And then I can imagine this thing where you've won the gold and now what do you do with your life? You know, and I think that's true of success in a lot of disciplines, not just Olympics. Okay, getting into fortitude. This is the first of six tests of leadership, these mental muscles, these characteristics that we're developing. And just to kind of lay the groundwork for listener here, this book has, I cannot stress this enough, for every one of these six tests of leadership, fortitude, confidence, boldness, the messaging, decision-making, goal focus, Scott gives you really specific habits to cultivate and develop. But then, not just here's the habit you need to cultivate, but then here's how you do it step by step. And when, like you said, Scott, doesn't mean it's easy, it's hard work, but you give us the roadmap, and that's just so important. So before we dive in, can you just tell us a little bit about why habits, why these frameworks, like, because you're really intentional about this.
Yeah, I really work hard at that. You know, here's the thing. I mentioned before, David, that we all know we have to self-regulate, but man, it is really hard. It is really hard. It is really hard to do that. So what helps us in moments like that is building the habits. Habits, of course, they're like these little wired steps that we have in our brain that lead to mental strength. As I often say, I believe that building the right habits are what train your brain for achievement. If you actually build habits to be mentally stronger, it is the same thing as training your brain for achievement. So because it's so hard to be mentally strong, I have spent a long time studying habit building science and trying to figure out what is it about habits? Why do they stick? Why don't they stick? And for each tool in the Mentally Strong Leader, you know, I even include sections that to help you build the habits, like, okay, so what's the first step you take? And what do you do when you break down in a moment of weakness, which is inevitably going to happen when you're trying to build a new habit. So it's that habit building science that's built into that, David, is the assist I'm trying to give the reader so they can actually train their brain to be mentally stronger and train their brain for achievement.
That framework is so powerful, and you'll see it represented. I want to dive into several of just some examples. There are over 50 different habits in all across all of these six tests of leadership. But just to call out a few, let's dive into fortitude and start there. And by the way, there's a self-assessment in the book that walks you through so you can figure out, okay, with six of these characteristics to choose from, where should I start? You make it easy for us to figure that out. Here's the one that maybe is going to have the biggest gain for me if I go there. So when we talk about fortitude, a couple of the habits that you draw out, one of them right off the bat, really powerful, is the habit of reframing setbacks.
Yeah.
And you have these lenses that you walk through different lenses to look through setbacks and so forth. But I'm going to just turn it over to you to tell us about reframing setbacks. And because again, it's like you said, intuitively, okay, yeah, I know I need to look at, find the opportunity in a problem. Okay, fine. But you get way more practical than that.
Yeah, I try to, remembering that, a lot with fortitude. That's the first thing people think of, David, is, when you think of mental strength, it's, well, yeah, I have to be resilient. Yes, well, I know that. And it's a topic that's been written about to death. So I spent an awful lot of time trying to understand, David, really what discerns organizations and people that consistently show more resilience than everyone else. And it really is this ability to reframe the way that they look at setbacks. You can choose to look at them as something that devastates you, or you can choose to look at them through a different lens. And one of the tools in the Mentally Strong Leader that you're referring to, I call it kind of the four lenses of resilience, different ways that you can look at setbacks. I'll give you a few examples. So, of course, the first lens is, what I call the agreeable adversity. And it's something that I can't not mention, even if it's obvious to your listeners. We have to find, first and foremost, the agreeable adversity. What is there in the setback that we can learn from? What might actually present an opportunity for us? Like you said, that's the first thing we think of, right? So I start by sharing, you have to find the agreeable adversity, because no matter how painful it is, you're almost going to always find something agreeable about it to take and move forward. But then, I get a lot more specific. I talk about what I call, the gratitude lens. And see, the thing is, when we lose something in the face of a setback, David, we focus on what we've lost. Maybe we lost time. Maybe we lost money. We lost resources. Maybe we lost our identity. Maybe we lost, God forbid, our job or a boss that we love to work for. If it's a corporate reorganization, we focus on what we've lost. And the gratitude lens does the opposite. It asks you to stay focused on what you still have in the face of that adversity. And I even came across a really powerful mathematical formula you can use to help you this. I call it the distance principle, which says this: the distance between how far you've come on something minus the setback, minus the misstep. And notice it's called a misstep, David, not a misleap, because we often exaggerate how far back a setback takes us. That distance between how far you've come in something minus the misstep, that remaining distance, is something still to be proud of. It's what social psychologists call the distance principle. Not forgetting how far you've come despite that adversity, which we can all forget quickly.
So fast.
I also encourage us to, think about the respond lens versus the react lens. And, the truth is, when it comes to fortitude, it's not about eliminating emotion. It's about managing that emotion. And you could choose to respond or react. And I often encourage people to, hey, you're a human being, you're not a robot. React internally, respond externally. And if you allow that reaction internally to become your response externally, most often what happens, David, is you show up overly emotional, not in control. You end up saying something that you didn't want to say. You end up catastrophizing that setback, and it could take you down a dark rabbit hole. Instead, if you think to yourself, okay, I'm not just going to react, I'm going to respond, your energy shifts in that moment to focusing on taking action. Not eliminating reaction, because we're human beings, but taking action. And I have found, and I've proven this by placing this tool in many an organization, David, when you encourage an organization to, we need to eliminate the word react, we need to focus on the word respond, it really helps change the mindset of, I understand I'm going to react emotionally, I'm not going to let that dominate the day and translate into how I show up. I'm going to respond by being intentional and put my energy into the action I'm going to take, not lamenting where we are emotionally. And one last lens I'll point on that I also talk about is just what I call the perspective lens, David, not forgetting that. Don't look at your setback in a vacuum. Remember that you can draw strength from others. And one of the most powerful tools we have to overcome setbacks is to draw from other people. And it's just to remember, what are your resilience needs? For me, I'll give you a personal example, David. Like when something goes wrong, usually for me, I've cultivated my network such that I know who I'm going to lean on to have a laugh. I am the type of person that likes to laugh through adversity, laugh at myself most often, make fun of myself, and I can call up, you know, one of my brothers who is very skilled at making fun of me. And, you know, we can have a laugh about, everybody has different resilience needs. You know, other people might be like, man, when I feature a setback, experience a setback, I need a wise soul to calm me down, someone who's been there. Other people might be, I just need someone to listen so I can vent. It's about understanding what your resilience needs are, cultivating that network, so that you can go get broader perspective outside of just your own. So I just rifled through four of the lenses of resilience in the Mentally Strong Leader, but I found them to be very, very powerful ways to reframe in a way that it creates a habit and it actually works. It's not just concept and theory you've heard 1,000 times before.
Exactly. And that's the power of every single one of these habits. They work. You know, as you were talking there, Scott, I was thinking about, this season that we're in is sponsored by our latest product, the Synergy Stack, which is a collaboratory card deck that the teams are using, and it's doing very, very well. But as I was thinking about what you were saying, there would be no Synergy Stack if it weren't for some, and I'm going to put this in quotes, failed product launches that we had had in earlier years, and even things that didn't lose us money, but they didn't have the success we would have hoped. And all of the learning that was available in that, so that the product development for this was so much better, you know, and that's why you just put it in somebody's hands and they're off and running and so forth. But none of that happens without the adversity of those things and learning or looking for all those opportunities that you're talking about and the gratitude lens, the responding versus reacting. That doesn't mean we didn't feel bad about those things, but
that's right.
What do you do with that going forward? All right, so we're talking about the fortitude framework. That's the habit of reframing setbacks. I want to do one other one that I loved there's so many of these for each one of these, but another fortitude one that I just loved was mind the grind. And I thought this was fabulous. A way of framing this particular habit. So mind the grind being the day to day, like, oh my gosh, here we are again. I'm doing this thing I've done 75 times before. And it's so easy to put our brain on autopilot and miss the joy and let that suck the life out of us when that doesn't have to be. We can cultivate a different habit. So what is mind the grind all about?
Yeah, it's the slow death of fortitude. That's how I like to think about it. It's knowing that you could be the most resilient person in the world, David, but let's face it, it doesn't matter what you do for a living, how much you love it. There's a grind to it. We've heard professional athletes talk about embracing the grind. You know, Tom Brady, the longtime quarterback, is very famous for, you know, embracing the suck, as is, you know, many folks in the military camp. You know, we all know that that can be a really, really hard thing to do, to embrace the suck and the grind at times. So I started practicing something that I call grindfulness to help you.
I love grindfulness.
And grindfulness is really, it's a combination of gratitude and mindfulness. And in the middle of that is grindfulness. And it's being present in daily life and noticing details in the grind of it all. And in that moment, expressing appreciation and joy for those details in the moment to give you little doses of gratitude and help. And neither, and I'll give you an example. First of all, neither gratitude nor mindfulness on its own is actually ever really enough to help us truly be resilient. And that's because, you know, first of all, when it comes to giving gratitude, David, this isn't my opinion, this is research and fact. Most of us place too high a bar on what we're going to be grateful for. And, you know, a lot of reasons why gratefulness can still be a helpful basic practice is people are reminded to, oh yeah, I just got to remember to be grateful for things in my life. But even when you remind people of that, we hold too high of a bar for what we should be grateful of. Mindfulness on its own isn't enough either to really fuel resilience, because while mindfulness is helpful, it's about calming yourself, being present in the moment, noticing what's going on. Fortitude requires more than just noticing it. You have to take action and do something about that so you don't continue to spiral down. So in the middle, I found this practice of grindfulness, which is, you know, really experiencing joy in the small details of daily life. Perfect example. I had someone who called me up and said, you know, hey, I read your book and this happened to me the other day. In fact, one of the exact examples I talk about, they had a long week at work. It was just the grind. They had a big customer call they were preparing for. They had to drive home and get groceries on Friday night, about the last thing they felt like doing. And they left a little bit earlier that day. So when they were coming home, the sun was just setting. And they noticed this time in their drive that the sun was sparkling off the leaves in the wind that were blowing. And it just caused this moment of kind of a commune with nature. And it was a powerful moment for them, because they said, they stopped and they paused. It's amazing that I live on a planet that can produce sights like that. And what happens when you notice details in the grind of your routine? Remember, they were on their routine, going to the grocery store like they do every Friday. This time they noticed something about their time that triggered an appreciation despite the grind. That's grindfulness. And when you get good at it, it's really, really a powerful way to bring resilience into your life in little drips and drabs in places you wouldn't expect it to come from.
I love that so much. Grindfulness. That is a fantastic concept. So mind the grind, cultivating our grindfulness. The combination of gratitude and mindfulness in those moments, in the routine of things that can put a stop to the, what did you call it, the slow death of fortitude?
The slow death of resilience and fortitude.
The slow death of fortitude and resilience. Our guest today, Scott Motch, the book is The Mentally Strong Leader, so many practical ways to cultivate these habits to help you develop the mental strength. We've been talking about fortitude. Let's go to confidence. One, I think, is another one that is, and again, there's fortitude, confidence, boldness, messaging, decision-making, goal focus. We're not gonna be able to hit all these, but I do wanna draw out one or two maybe from confidence, and then we'll get to boldness. So when we're talking about confidence, let's first define, what do you mean by confidence just as a concept? What does that muscle at the big level look like? Then we'll call out a couple of these habits.
Yeah, I think the most important thing to remember, David, is, it's very helpful for people to understand what confidence is not. It helps define what it is. Confidence, most importantly, is not the absence of self-doubt. It isn't. It's about how we monitor our relationship with doubt, which will exist. And David, I have lost track of the amount of people that I have been interviewing on this topic. It's been a real passion of mine for decades. I have lost track of the number of people that I've come across, David, that I would brand as, man, their confidence muscle is bulging. They believe in themselves. They believe in their opportunities. They believe in what they're doing. And despite that, I have yet to run into any of them that would admit I never have a wink of self-doubt anywhere. If they did, they'd be delusional, and I'd be worried about them, in my data set, to be honest with you. We all, even the most confident people, have to manage this self-doubt that exists within us. So confidence is actually your ability to monitor your relationship with doubt. And I don't know if that definition surprises you or not, but I think it's a pretty helpful delineation.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate the definition, which is why I wanted you to call that out for all of us, because I think many times it's easy to kind of misunderstand what confidence actually is. And part of the habits that you get into are really about managing, monitoring these relationships. So the first habit I wanted to call out in this area of confidence is handling criticism effectively.
Yeah.
And you really give us a blow-by-blow kind of three steps. And again, just so practical and some elements that I thought were really helpful. You know, as I'm reading about it and thinking about when I handle criticism well and when I don't handle it so well and where I need to be practicing this. So let's walk through, how do we handle criticism effectively?
Yeah, I offer the readers three steps. And David, I don't share anything that hasn't been proven. It's just a point of pride to me. And sometimes people are surprised that I found a model to handle criticism, because everyone assumes we all handle it personally in different ways. And while that might be true, there are some universal truths that can help you. Three steps. The first step, I think, surprises people sometimes, David, where I ask people to say, your first job is to decide who gets to criticize you.
Yes.
Because not all criticizers are created equal. Not everyone gets a seat at the table. Your boss, your boss's boss, your wife, oh yeah, your significant other, your partner, sure. Bob in accounting, who doesn't seem to like you, they can pound salt. They don't get a vote. They don't get to criticize you. So I found it's really, really important to start from that place, because not everyone gets a vote on whether or not they can criticize you. So does that mean if someone's criticizing you that doesn't make the cut, you rudely get up and walk away from them? No, that's not what I'm saying at all. You could still use the next two steps. You still need to open that up with whether or not this person is qualified to, as Brené Brown says, are you in the arena or not? If you're not in the arena, I don't want to hear from you. If they're in your arena, okay, listen to what they have to say. And then the next step is, and this is really important, it's just to neutralize your first reaction and just listen. And I don't know about you, David, you know, I've learned to get, to really look forward almost in some ways to criticism because I do feel like it makes me stronger. That said, I'm not going to lie to you, that initial reaction could sting. Yep. Your heart rate, you can't control it. It goes up a little bit. You're about to hear something that isn't reflective of who you want to be, what you want to, who you are perhaps, or the kind of output you want to put into that world. So it stings. You have to resist that. You have to acknowledge that your heart's racing. Avoid defensiveness kicking in. Recognize that it hurts. And in fact, I even talk about in the book that psychology researchers have shown that the brain actually registers physical pain in the same exact spot that it registers social rejection. So that literally criticism can seem to sting. And sometimes it physically feels that way because the brain can't discern between social rejection and actual pain sometimes. That's how difficult it is for us. So it's important you just neutralize that initial reaction and just listen.
I thought that's
partial deflating, right? David, yeah, please.
Yeah, that word neutralize, that's the, I underlined that a couple times as I was reading through this, is it's not that we're not going to have that reaction.
Right.
I think that's important, is that criticism has a physical sting to it, right? Everything you just described. It's what do we do with that? How do we neutralize it? How do we keep that from dominating our external response, right? You said internal react, external respond, neutralize it so that we can just listen.
That's right, David, because you can't change the words that are spoken to you, but you can assign the meaning that you give to those words that are spoken to you. And in the book, you know, I share one of my favorite quotes from Eleanor Roosevelt, who said, and you probably have heard this one before, you know, no one can make you feel inferior without your consent. And that gets to the ability of you to neutralize, truly neutralize, and just listen. That's the second step, which leads us to the third step, which is you have to find the nugget. And I encourage people to visually think of a strainer, like a colander. Imagine if you had a colander and you were pouring, I don't know, flour in the colander, and you shook that colander and you sifted and the flour came through the colander. You have to think about all the noise in your brain as that flour building up in the colander. And what you're doing, kind of like a miner panning for gold, you're shaking that colander to get rid of the distraction, to find what's the core essence of something that's really going to help you. And the truth is, David, more times than not, and it depends on what study you believe and what study you follow, most studies will say that in 80% of the cases, at least, there is truly something that the receiver of that criticism could look back on and say, that really helped me. You might not see it in the moment. And sometimes if you're giving criticism to someone, you may not experience they're appreciative of it in the moment. You get that a lot as a leader, but later on down the line, they'll tell you how appreciative they were. That's because they ultimately found the nugget. And that's what you have to do too. There is more than likely going to be some truth to what has been said, even if the person seems like they're coming across as vindictive. And you've probably seen that to be true. Is that right, David? Even when someone's telling you something you don't want to hear, if you can resist the emotional reaction, isn't it true that most often there's some essence of something that's true about that you can take and learn from?
I would say yes if they pass the first filter.
Exactly. So
if the filter was, like you said, they're in the game, I get to decide if this is relevant, if I'm going to give this person credence and listen to what they have to say. Because the people who don't make that cut, I think are, their criticism, it's about them.
Yes.
Whatever they're saying, there's nothing really to do with me. It's more to do with them. So that, no. But if they pass that filter, then yeah, 80% is probably low, probably higher than that. 90, 95, 99% of the time, there's going to be something of value in there.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And it's hard for us, you know, it's hard for us to say you don't make the cut mentally, and you don't want to over dismiss that so that the world of people that can criticize you is now like one person. You know, you want to keep a broad net, right? I'm just asking the listeners to discern in that net of who is really going to count when it comes to giving criticism.
Yeah, it's like for me, it's do I believe they have my best interest at heart?
Yes.
If I believe, whether I've been criticized, I remember I gave a keynote one time, I think I've talked about this in a past episode, but I gave a keynote one time up in Detroit, and I had a participant approach me afterwards, and she had some pretty hefty criticism for me. And a lot of the time, I don't take that to heart, because many times the person has their own agenda, they're trying to prove that they're smarter, or they're trying to prove something to their friend, or, you know, they have a lot of, there are a lot of motivations people can have. But I didn't know this woman from anybody, but she had my best interest at heart, I have no doubt. And yeah, that criticism stung. It stung for a couple of days, and I had to process it with some trusted advisors and things to get that nugget for sure. But it was there. So I think, yes, as wide a filter as I can of people who have my best interest at heart is always going to be good.
That's right. You're just trying to not give unwarranted influence to people who shouldn't have it, David.
Yeah.
That's yeah. Really at the end what that first step is all about.
For sure. And then neutralize that first reaction, listen, find the nugget. All right. Another habit, and I'm looking at the time going, oh no, we're going to run out of time. This one, I, you know, if I were to say this one is worth the entire book, it probably already the habits we've talked about are worth the entire book. But this habit within confidence of monitoring your relationship with yourself, I mean, it could almost be a book to itself.
Yeah.
It's that valuable. And you know, in your description of even what confidence is, you were talking about monitoring our relationship with self-doubt and so forth. So I wonder if it's going to be hard to do, maybe, but to give us some of the highlights of this process of the framework of monitoring your relationship with yourself in terms of how we develop that kind of a habit and what it does for us.
Yeah. So I was mentioning there's two tools in the book in the Mentally Strong Leader, David. You know, one is the doubt continuum that helps you to monitor your relationship with doubt. The one you're referring to is, you know, what I call the self-acceptance scale. And it, you know, this has, I won't bore you with, you know, the data science and data scientists involved in validating this for me, but there's a tool I call the self-acceptance scale. And to paint the picture for the listener, I want them to picture a scale, right? Kind of a horizontal scale. On the left side of the scale is what you're going for, which is self-acceptance. Self-acceptance is inexorably linked to confidence. Makes sense. That's what we all want. We want to be able to accept ourselves. And when you self-accept, that's when you're in your highest mode of self-regulation. You're not allowing all the junk in your life to filter in and make you doubt, you know, make you do anything less than accept yourself. On the other side of the scale is the opposite, which is something that, you know, has been termed and coined imposter syndrome. And that is where your regulation is at its lowest level. In between are varying degrees of how our self-acceptance degrades over time, whether or not we realize it's happening to us. And the farther we move to the right on this scale of all of these different elements, which I'll very quickly touch on, the more our self-confidence erodes and we don't even realize it. And I've been able to prove this over time, but so you start with self-acceptance on the left side of the scale. That's what you want. But then you have a little bit of a slip, right? It's this thing called approval seeking. It's the first degree of failure in self-acceptance. You start to seek approval from others. You start to kind of, well, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm not as good as I thought. You start to make, you know, irrelevant comparisons to other people, which I'll get to in a second, but you really start to seek approval from other people because you feel like, well, geez, I don't know, man, maybe I'm not doing this well enough. Maybe this just isn't right. I really want to reach out to somebody else, you know, forgetting that sometimes the enemy is the internal me, right? Beyond approval seeking, we could start to compare to others. And now self-acceptance starts to degrade even more. And just so I'm clear, I'm not saying comparing to others can't be beneficial. That could be great. I do it all the time, David. I'll compare it to other people in my industry to say, do I have the skill set that they do? Am I showing up as strongly as they do? And that's a healthy thing. It helps test your, what I'm talking about is irrelevant comparisons. We tend to, especially in social media, we put everybody on a pedestal and we compare all of our, you know, blooper reels to all of their highlight reels. We assume that our success of people that we don't know we shouldn't be comparing to, we assume their success is due to they're better than me, they're more skilled than me, I'm just an idiot, I can't, and fill in the blank. And so we start to make these irrelevant comparisons to others. Moving along the spectrum, there's another degree of degradation of self-acceptance, which is our negative inner chatter starts to kick in. We start to beat ourselves up more frequently with thoughts, beliefs, and emotions that are of no use. We forget that sometimes the enemy is the internal me, and that we just get in our own way. One step further to the right is where we truly believe, David, we're not enough. One of the greatest forms of degradation of self-acceptance. And I would love for your listeners to really take this to heart when I say this. And if I was on camera, or if they could see me on camera, they'd see me looking right into the lens when I say this. And I want them to hear this. You are enough. And you don't have to take on everything by yourself. You are enough. And you don't have to take on everything by yourself. But when our self-acceptance continues to degrade, we can fall into this pattern where all of these things accumulate into a belief that we're not enough, until it can end up on the far right of the scale where imposter syndrome kicks in and we actually believe we don't deserve what we've gotten. We believe like that's externally forced on us by someone else. It wasn't our internal doing that we are where we are today. So I talk through the entire scale, then of course, solutions for how to solve each one of these degradations of self-acceptance along the way, with very specific tools to help the listener along the way.
Yeah, I just cannot emphasize enough the value of, there's so many different amazing habits and principles and practical suggestions throughout the book, but this is one of the best treatments, I think, of this subject, Scott, that I've seen, of this continuum of these various ways that happens for us, and then how do we stop that, and how do we rebuild it at each of those levels. So powerful and so critically important as a leader. If we're going to have all the benefit of all the things you listed up front, that ability to navigate and manage our emotions and our responses and so forth, particularly through, if we're not centered and grounded in ourself, that's impossible. It just can't happen. And so to have a framework that we can use to go through and really navigate that is so powerful. So I really appreciate you putting this into the book, but then also walking us through it here. And I really want to encourage listeners, this is worth getting the book, The Mentally Strong Leader by Scott Motz, Mautz, to check this out. And it's just one example. There are so many more. We've only talked about, I think, three or four habits up to, there are 50 more. There's 50 plus habits in this book. Scott, where can we connect with you, find out more? You've got some resources for us. Where should we go?
Yeah, for sure. Listeners can find me at scottmautz.com. You can learn about all the keynotes that I give, the training that I do. You can find the book, The Mentally Strong Leader, there. And maybe more importantly, I put together a free resource, David, for listeners of your wonderful show. It really helps bring soul back into your leadership, the show, and I hope this book. But you'll get a free resource. If you go to scottmautz.com/mentallystronggift, you can download a 60-page free PDF. And what's included in this is very important. You mentioned it up front. But the book contains a 50-question self-assessment. So you can determine, and this has been determined and validated through a lot of data science, you can determine how mentally strong are you overall, and how strong are you on each one of the six mental muscles that we've been talking about: fortitude, confidence, boldness, decision-making, goal focus, and messaging. So you can take that and then discern, okay, this is where I need to start. So you can effectively build your own tailored mental strength training program. So again, you can get that, the 60-page PDF that includes the questionnaire as well as prompts for how to get the most out of the book, at scottmautz.com/mentallystronggift.
So many opportunities there. Scott, I want to ask you, as we get close to wrapping up here, it pains me that we're not going to get to share some of these. I'm thinking of boldness and the habits of thinking big, and the, you have the COIN acronym to help us change the group narrative. And so I'm just giving those out because there's just, again, so many of the listeners. I really want you to check these out. They're just so valuable. Scott, I'm wondering if you can maybe anchor us as we're thinking about all of these. And I know that this is going to be in the 60-page guide that you just recommended, that free gift. And thank you for that. as we do the work to figure out, okay, which of these do I want to focus on? Let me choose that one habit I want to start cultivating and building. What do you recommend in terms of a daily practice to get that? Because you talk about, we need the reps. We need the repetitions, just like any other muscle, in order to build this. So how do you recommend we get moving in that regard?
Yeah, I think the most important point, David, is if listeners can really, it really starts with being self-motivated enough to understand what you have to work on. So when you start by taking the self-strength, the mental strength self-assessment, you understand this isn't for everybody. This is for me. This is what I individually, uniquely need to work on first. So that will motivate you. Then, you know, at the end of the book, I encourage people to create what I call, you know, a map, a mental action plan. You use the book and you go through starting from, okay, these are the muscles that I have to work on, you know, my mental muscles. Got it. I have no expectation, David, that everybody uses every tool in this book. You can't. It wasn't written that way. It's meant to be a menu so that you could say, okay, I don't need to focus on these three tools because I'm pretty good at that. I don't really need to build a new habit there because that happens to me naturally. But once you can assess your own pattern, your own plan, you can create your own map, mental action plan, to say, okay, I'm boiling it down to, and I'm making this up, David, I want to work on these four things. I'm going to use these four tools. Then you can kind of break it down to make it feel less intimidating. I'm going to work on these couple of muscles. After all, David, when you go to the gym, you don't go to work on every muscle all the time. Wednesday's back day, Thursday's leg day, Friday's arm day, whatever. So you could take the same approach and break it down like that in your own mental strength training program.
And it's cultivating that daily habit, whatever that looks like, or if it's every other day, whatever, however you're doing that. But that value of getting your repetitions in, it's not like you read this once, you do that one thing once, but it's a plan and it takes repetition. And one of the things I appreciate that you've referred to, Scott, is we're going to have those times we slip up and gosh, that didn't go as well as I would have liked, or I do find myself in that negative self-chatter, or I did react rather than respond, and okay, happens, let's recover and let's keep going. And you give us the blow by blow for each habit. How do we do that? And so again, part of the value of the book.
It's the nature of habit building. Yep.
Absolutely. All right. The book is The Mentally Strong Leader. Our guest today, Scott Motz, I cannot thank you enough for writing this book. As you said, so much research, 30 years worth of experience and a ton of research and validation gone into this. But you take all of that, Scott, and like you do, you make it so practical. And of course, you know, we're fans of that around here. So thank you for this and really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you so much, David. Thanks for having me back once again.
It's been our pleasure. All right, listener, there you go. Which of these mental muscles are you going to invest in? Is it fortitude, confidence, boldness, messaging, decision-making, or goal focus? I know for me, might be grindfulness. That might be my word of the day today. Scott, thanks again. And listeners, we'll see you next time on Leadership Without Losing Your Soul. Until then, be the leader you want your boss to be.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.